You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Good morning. It's great to see you today. I am going to hand out a couple of baskets here, and it's a locational hazard. I'm going to hand these out to Michael and Mary. And if you could go out and just kind of spread these out to different people. Don't pass them down a row. Give them to people all over the place. So today's passage is from Esther. We're going to be hearing passages or selections from Esther 3. And one of the things that you need to know is that of all the books in the Bible, Esther has the unique distinction of being the only book in the Bible that does not mention God. Does not mention God at all. It doesn't appear. Martin Luther is just one of many folks who didn't even think Esther should be in the Bible. In fact, he said, "I would it did not exist, for it has a great deal of heathenish naughtiness." Right? So you know it's got to be good. Yeah? So even though it is clearly fiction, with made-up kings and a made-up situation, it's a Jewish parable, if you will. The ancient rabbis and later Christian leaders felt it had an important enough message that it needed to be left in. Right? So here we've got Esther. It's a great story, and I encourage you to read it all. It's set during the Jewish exile to Babylon, and there are four main characters. The pagan Persian king of Babylon, his queen Esther, who is a Jew, although the king doesn't know it, Esther's uncle Mordecai, who is an older generation of Jew. He's still holding out against being assimilated or absorbed into the pagan culture of Babylon. And then there's Haman, the king's prime minister, a man who loves power, is full of pride, and looks to use his position to increase his own sense of importance. Now, this is a story that has lots of court intrigue. It's got drama. It's got sex. It's got all kinds of parallels in today's world, which leap out at you when you're sitting there reading the story. The story as a whole is the foundation of the Jewish holiday of Purim. And in order to emphasize Jewish disgust of the character Haman, Jews make it so that his name cannot be heard when the story is read. Right? In Harry Potter, they simply say, "He who," right? "He who shall not be named." But in our story today, we have, these are called groggers. What are they called? Groggers. Now, if you don't happen to have a grogger, you can also shake your keys. You can go, you can do whatever it is. The important thing is that whenever you hear the name Haman, all right, let's practice. Whenever you hear the name Haman, excellent. You use your grogger. Now, in today's passage, Uncle Morty brings the whole thing to a head when he refuses to bow down to pagan authority, and Haman plots to eliminate him and all of the Jews. So let's hear our story from Esther, if you can hear it, over the groggers.
After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him to the seat above the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and did obeisance to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or do obeisance. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" He told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or do obeisance to him, Haman was infuriated. But he thought it beneath him to lay down hands on Mordecai alone. So having been told who Mordecai's people were, Haman plotted to destroy all the Jews throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. When Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and separated among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not appropriate for the king to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued for their destruction, and I will pay tens of thousands talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, so that they may put it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, "The money is given to you and the people as well, to do with them as it seems good to you." Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces, giving orders to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree to every province by proclamation, calling on all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went quickly, and the king and Haman sat down to have a drink. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Let's pray. Loving and gracious Spirit, for these stories from long ago and the ways they cast in our imagination the challenge that we have before us to be faithful, we're grateful. And as we consider the implications for this story for our lives today and for our role as followers of Jesus, may the Spirit be with us and work its way into our hearts and minds so that none of us would leave this place unchanged. We gather as followers of Jesus. Amen. Well, it seems that one day, St. Peter was preparing for his annual vacation. And it just so happened that Jesus was up near the front gate and volunteered to actually watch the registration desk for Peter while he was gone. And Peter said, "You know, it's really no great shakes. Just when people come to the desk, just, you know, ask them their name, have them, tell you a little bit about themselves. And, you know, just be nice to them and then send them over to housekeeping to get their wings," right? Well, Jesus didn't quite have the hang of it yet when the next morning the first elderly gentleman came up and he just went straight to, tell me about yourself. And the man said, "Well, I'm a simple carpenter. And I was once the father to a son, a special child, unlike any other in the world. His birth was unique. He went through an incredible transformation. He suffered with holes in his hands and in his feet. He's been gone for a long time, but his spirit lives on. His story is told all over the world." Now, by this time, Jesus had his arms spread wide and his eyes were starting to swell with tears, and he embraced the old man and he said, "Father, it's been so long." And the old man kind of pushed himself away and squinted at Jesus and said, "Pinocchio?" Okay, you might get that later. All right. You know, it is amazing how sometimes we can be given a little bit of information and then jump to the wrong conclusion, right? And that's the way it is with our topic for today. It's the second in our I Believe series. And today it's I Believe in Religious Freedom. We're in the middle of a major identity crisis in our country today. And a lot of it has to do with our collective failure to embrace the original intention of our founders. And guess what? When we don't pay attention, there are plenty of nefarious actors who are more than happy to rush in and misrepresent the facts with actions that benefit themselves. Kind of sounds like Haman. In the book of Esther, it was who? Haman. Yeah. Who misrepresented the facts to benefit himself and his prejudices. Today, it's conservative fundamentalist Christians who are misrepresenting the facts to benefit themselves and their prejudices. Let me give you a couple of examples. I've talked before about the Ten Commandment monuments that are all over the country. There are five right here in Arizona, and I do not think that they belong on public grounds, courthouses, public libraries, parks, anywhere. They do not belong. And I've preached whole sermons on why that is the case. I refer you to those. Among other things, the Ten Commandments assumes that women are property, among other things, and any variety of other very primitive ideas that have no place in our modern civic culture. Never mind that the first placement of these monuments were a publicity stunt. Nothing to do with religion at all. They were put up by Cecil B. DeMille to promote the Ten Commandments movie. Don't believe me? There's Charlton Heston and Cecil B. DeMille right there putting one up in North Dakota. I kind of like this one. Yul Brynner, the Pharaoh himself, putting one up in Milwaukee, right? This was all a publicity stunt. And now you have people going so far out of the way to try and make a huge deal out of these being so religious when they didn't have a religious origin at all. It was a Hollywood publicity stunt that Cecil B. DeMille worked out with the Fraternal Order of Eagles. What about Hobby Lobby? Hobby Lobby successfully argued that requiring it to provide contraceptives was against the belief of its Baptist owners, who, incidentally, had been providing contraceptives for their workers through their health benefits all these years, up until the point when they objected on religious grounds because it was required in the Affordable Care Act. It was fine up until then. And in fact, they said, oh my gosh, now we're going to have to object and it's on religious grounds, which seemed a little disingenuous to me. How about Masterpiece Cake Shop? Jack Phillips, the owner of this bakery, won a Supreme Court appeal arguing that he didn't have to bake a cake for LGBTQ people because it violated his Christian beliefs. And keep your eye on Brush and Nib. The Brush and Nib case is right here in Arizona. These are a couple of Arizona young women. Two young fundamentalist women. They're artists who look bound for the Supreme Court, according to the paper this week, claiming that they shouldn't be expected to create invitations for LGBTQ people. Never mind that no one's asked them. Not a single person has asked them. They just want to go to SCOTUS to make sure that if someone does ask them, they can say no and have it be based on their religious prejudice, right? Now, this sounds to me a lot like many of the other prejudices that we have tried to overcome but still lurk in our country, be it not allowing African Americans to sit at lunch counters, women not voting, right? These are all things that were defended by religious grounds. Each one of these cases is grounded in religious-based discrimination, plain and simple. And all of them argue that the government, in doing its job, which is defending the dignity and rights of all its citizens. Would you agree? That's a good job for the government? That in doing its job, it is violating their God-given right to discriminate against them, gives them the freedom to be prejudiced. That's the argument. Wait, what? What? Is that right? Where did this idea come from? This idea of religious freedom? You hear it all the time right now, right? Religious freedom, religious liberty, it's everywhere. And how did it end up having the prime position as the very first amendment to the Constitution? Well, it goes back to 230 years ago when James Madison introduced the Bill of Rights to Congress. The very first amendment says that everyone in the United States has the right to practice his or her own religion or no religion at all, right? That's because the founders, who were of a variety of opinions about religion, knew that the best way to protect individuals' religious liberty was to keep the government out of the business of religion. Now, this is one of the major reasons that the United States has managed to avoid a lot of the religious conflicts that have torn so many other countries apart. So the First Amendment prohibits government from encouraging or establishing religion in any way. There's no official religion in the United States, no financial support of any particular religion, and everyone has the right to worship or not as they so choose without penalty. Right? That's one of the glories of the United States. But first thing you need to remember is that despite that, what a lot of partisan Christians claim is that few of the founders were conventional Christians. This was the age of the Enlightenment, and religion was under suspicion, especially when it came to state-established religion. John Adams wrote, "Nothing is more dreaded than the national government meddling with religion." Right? Because it had been the distinct experience of the founders that religion leads inexorably to persecution. That's why Thomas Paine wrote, "Persecution is not an original feature in any religion, but is always the strongly marked feature of religions established by law." And Washington himself said, "No one would be more zealous than myself to establish effectual barriers against the horrors of every species of religious persecution." That prevailing opinion is partly why our Constitution makes no mention of God whatsoever. Did you know that? No God in the Constitution. None. Now, that kind of omission is pretty obvious early on. And when he was asked about it, Alexander Hamilton responded, "Well, our new nation is not in need of any foreign aid." Right? And when he was pressed To give a serious response, he answered the question with a flippant, we forgot to put God in the Constitution? If you know anything about Alexander Hamilton, you know he didn't forget anything. But there was a problem. In 1619, the colony of Virginia established the Church of England as its official religion. It had become such a dominant force in the state that when Baptist pastor John Leland traveled to Virginia in 1775, he witnessed not only the persecution and imprisonment of his fellow Baptist preachers, but he was threatened himself with a gun. Why? Because he was a Baptist. Now, I don't know, you may have felt that way about some Baptists, but it's not legal, right? So, after he was threatened with the gun, Leland worked tirelessly to oppose the establishment of religion in any form. A Baptist preacher, right? He eventually played an important role in securing the Bill of Rights. He petitioned President Washington with the claim that Baptists feared that the Constitution failed to secure the liberty of conscience, he called it. His correspondence with Thomas Jefferson and his grassroots organizing led Virginia to eventually adopt Jefferson's Statute for Religious Freedom in 1786. And his work with Madison led directly to the First Amendment. Have you ever heard of him? He's an American hero, a Baptist pastor. He was an ardent supporter of Thomas Jefferson. He wrote letters, he organized demonstrations, and he was a pretty savvy showman. On January 1st in 1801, Leland arrived at the White House with the gift of a giant wheel of cheese for the newly elected President Jefferson. Now, when I say giant wheel of cheese, I mean mammoth is what it's referred to in the history books. It was 4 feet in diameter. It was 13 feet in circumference. And it weighed 1,235 pounds, reportedly made from the milk of 900 Republican cows. Emblazoned on the red crust was Jefferson's favorite motto, religion or rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Right? Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Later that very same day, the same day that the mammoth cheese arrived at the White House, Jefferson sat down and penned his famous letter to the Danbury Baptist Association that contains the words, "The wall of separation between church and state." Now, if that wasn't enough, in 1820, Leland's demands for continued church-state separation and equal rights went like this. Government should protect every man in thinking and speaking freely and see that one does not abuse another, he wrote. The liberty I contend for is more than toleration. Now think about this. This is 1820. He said, the very idea of toleration is despicable. It supposes that some have a preeminence above the rest to grant indulgence, whereas all should be equally free, Jews, Turks, pagans, and Christians. Right? That's everybody. That's everybody. Today, a place like Flushing, New York, is a poster child for the kind of religious pluralism that Leland imagined. Hundreds of houses of worship, 6 different Hindu temples, dozens of Korean churches. Share the neighborhood with Buddhists, Sikhs, Muslims, Taoists, Mormons, Catholics, Protestants. Jews can choose from three flavors of Judaism: Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox. And maybe it's just that kind of pluralism that has some Christians running scared and feeling like they need to exert their influence on the culture at large. So just a few years ago in 2015, a nationwide campaign run by the Congressional Prayer Caucus Foundation, Wall Builders, led by disgraced Christian Dominionist David Barton, and other Christian political groups established a group to pass bills that encourage the government to promote their particular brand of Christianity. They call it, this drives me nuts, they call it Project Blitz. Right? Have you heard of it? Never heard of it? Good, that's the way they like it. All the better for them to quietly and incrementally inject fundamentalist religion into our collective legislature. In 2018 alone, Project Blitz legislators, a number of whom are right here in Arizona, introduced 74 bills in 27 states that not only promote a very narrow kind of Christianity above other religions, but seek to transform the idea of religious freedom from a shield into a sword that can be used to harm others. These bills include Religious Freedom Restoration Acts and First Amendment Defense Acts that would allow state-funded adoption and foster care agencies to use religion as an excuse to deny children to prospective parents, and let state governments create religious exemptions that undermine advances in LGBTQ civil rights and women's reproductive rights. That means creating laws that protect fundamentalist pharmacists who refuse to fill prescriptions for birth control, fundamentalist bakers who refuse to bake cakes, and generally moving towards establishing a Handmaid's Tale-style dystopian future. Now look, I am not the only crazy person who is worried about this. Last summer, the Presbyterian Church, the PCUSA, took an historic step, and they overwhelmingly passed a resolution embracing genuine religious freedom and opposing the religious rights abuse of this founding principle of American democracy. The resolution says, "The principle of religious freedom should not mean the right to discriminate against or impose one's views upon others." Right? That seems simple, doesn't it? The United Methodist Social Principles is already on board with this. We strongly oppose the state promoting or favoring particular religious beliefs, particularly when it harms other people. So why do I care? Why should you care? Because as a historically mainline Christian, what I am, what many of you would be considered, I have become a religious minority. And I don't want the majority trampling on my beliefs. I have the right to live my life without interference from aggressive religious groups who want to impose their doctrines on me with the help or non-action of the government. I also don't want the government oppressing or compromising the civil rights of my friends and loved ones who are LGBTQ, Muslim, Hispanic, Jewish, or, I don't know, women. So let me turn to the wisdom of that great theologian, George Carlin, for our stream of thought. I'm completely in favor of the separation of church and state. My idea is that these two institutions screw us up enough on their own, so both of them together is certain death. Now, I hear a lot these days about freedom of religion and religious liberty, and I think if you pay attention, you're going to hear a lot about it too. But I am not convinced that most of the people talking about it have any clue whatsoever of what these ideas really mean or where they come from. A few years ago, I attended curriculum night at my son Nat's school. The parents, you know, we traipse around to each classroom to meet the teachers and to get a taste of what each class was studying. Now, in Nat's Humane Letters class, which is a synthesis of social studies and English, the teacher gave us a copy of the Mayflower Compact. It was actually printed in a way that we could read it. Asked us to read it, and then for the parents to expound on the principles that it expressed. And what, pray tell, did the teacher want us to deduce from reading the Mayflower Compact? That the Puritans came to North America to promote religious freedom, right? You all know the drill, right? That's the word in the streets. Okay, then, if you're ever in Boston and wander up to the State House on Beacon Hill, you'll find a statue of one of my heroes, a woman named Mary Dyer, who, incidentally, is a direct ancestor of our own Gretchen Anderson here at the Fountains. Anyway, Mary was raised a Puritan, but while visiting England, she joined the Society of Friends, right? Commonly known as the Quakers, right? Well, when she returned to Massachusetts, she was promptly arrested by the ruling Puritan authorities and banished to Rhode Island on religious grounds. Whew, that's bad. But Mary returned to Boston to minister to imprisoned Quakers. After all, she was part of a peace movement that fosters mercy, grace, and nonviolence above all. These, of course, are heresies that the Puritans evidently didn't want any part of. And so, as you do, they executed Mary Dyer, along with several other Quakers. You gotta love those Puritans, huh? They came to North America to promote religious freedom as long as it was their way. You get where I'm coming from? So I believe in religious freedom. But it's the freedom our founders had in mind. The kind of freedom I think Jesus and Paul and Wesley had in mind. A freedom that is one of the bedrock principles that makes the United States the kind of country that no one ever imagined could exist until we made it so. I believe in religious freedom, but we have to be vigilant against the abuses of Puritans of the past and fundamentalists of the present who seek to visit upon us in the name of piety and superiority ways of being that harm us and our friends and other Americans. So regardless of cost, I stand with Uncle Mordecai in opposing the demands of modern-day Hamans demanding that we bow down to their self-promotion and prejudices. And I hope you'll stand with me too. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com.